Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Every year, the Multnomah County Library chooses one book they hope the whole county will read. The program's called Everybody Reads, and between January and April, the library and their partner organizations host events based around the themes of the book, and they distribute thousands of copies for free to readers and writers of all ages from across the county. Here at Literary Arts, our role is to bring the author to town for a talk at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as the culminating event. This year, the Everybody Reads book was Mohsen Hammad's celebrated novel, Exit West. He's, of course, also the author of three other novels, including The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which was made into a movie in 2012. Exit West is a love story, a portrait of daily life in a war zone, and a revelation of the cost of migration and immigration. In the novel, a young couple, Saeed and Nadia, leave an unnamed country ripped apart by civil war, exiting through magical doors to a new country in hope of finding a better life. The story is at once timeless and of our time, real and surreal, ancient and modern, intimate and ambitious, terrifying and hopeful. The novel does what great literature does best, humanize and make personal historic moments that can feel detached from our own experience. So in this episode, we have a riveting hour with Mohsen Hammad, who connects his own nomadic life with the themes and characters of Exit West and ultimately demonstrates that we are all migrants. Here's Hammad.
Thank you. I thought what I'd do tonight was speak a little bit about myself and then focus really on this book as a lens to think about writing, to think about politics, to think about life. But I'll begin by just telling you a little bit about myself. Some of you may have heard me speak before, so I won't speak at too much length about this, but I think it's useful to have a sense of who someone is when talking about their writing. And so I'm someone who has constantly moved. I was born in Pakistan in 1971, and when I was 3 years old, my father, a university professor, got into a PhD program in California and moved us, my mother and I, to California. And when I arrived in California, something very strange happened because I spoke Urdu fluently, but I didn't speak a word of English. And we moved into the identical townhouses on the university campus where the graduate students lived. And my mother heard crying shortly after we moved in, and she stepped outside to see what it was, and it was me at the house next to our house, looking up at a befuddled stranger thinking, you know, you're not my mother, and he looking down at this tearful Pakistani boy thinking, you know, who are you? And I was surrounded by the children of this place, the children of the other graduate students who looked like a, you know, little United Nations sort of Benetton commercial of childhood. And one of them said to my mother, what's the matter with him? Why can't he speak? And she said, he can speak. Well, he can't speak properly. No, he can speak properly. He just doesn't speak English yet. And this must have been upsetting for me because my parents told me that after this incident, I didn't speak again for a month. I was completely silent. They thought perhaps I should see a doctor, and in the end they decided to wait. This being the early 1970s and the instinct to imagine that children require urgent medical intervention, I think was less in those days. Or maybe they were just lazy, or perhaps even relieved, you know, that I was being quiet. And I think that they waited, and I sat in front of our black and white TV set, a television set that I would, for my entire childhood, think was a color TV set, because I saw colors in this black and white television set, and it wasn't until much later that I discovered it really was black and white, and I was sort of imagining these colors. But anyway, I sat in front of this TV for a month. And when I next spoke, my parents were surprised to find that I spoke in English in complete sentences with an American accent. And, you know, kids do these things. And so I was then a Californian boy. I didn't really have any recollection of Pakistan when I moved back home to Pakistan 6 years later, at the age of 9. I had no memory of what Pakistan was like, and my parents were shocked to discover when we landed in Pakistan that I also no longer spoke a word of Urdu. I only knew English, and I arrived in Pakistan as a Californian American child who found this place completely foreign. And that initial migration back to Pakistan, the second migration of my life, was total in a way that I think young people today might struggle to understand. So I'm going to say a little bit about it. Today, when you move countries, it's possible to be in touch with people through the internet, through instant messaging, phone calls, video calls, emails. But when I moved back, none of these things existed. There were phone calls, but they were incredibly expensive. Children didn't generally call each other internationally. I certainly never did. And so in 1980, when we moved back to Pakistan in the end of 1980, I never heard or saw or had any contact with any of my friends ever again. And as a 9-year-old, I then began a new life in Pakistan. I had to learn the language. I had to figure out how to fit in. And I did this, and then I moved back to America later, and then for college, and worked in New York, and moved to London for many years, and then moved back to Pakistan. I tell you this because I suppose the novel Exit West is a novel I've been writing my entire life, you know, certainly since I was at least 3 years old, because I've been fundamentally defined by the experience of migration. So much so that I don't really have a first language. My first language, Urdu, was lost to me at the age of 3, and English then became my best language, but it wasn't my first language. And Urdu, I had to relearn when I was 9, 10 years old, so it became, in a sense, my third language, and now I don't really have a first language. I'm somebody who is thoroughly mongrelized. You know, I'm part Pakistani, part American, I suppose part British, part this, part that. And so the world we live in today, which is a world where increasingly people are beginning to ask whether or not, you know, migrants are desirable, whether we shouldn't retreat into some kind of purity. This anti-migrant, pro-purity sentiment is something that I take very personally. I find it, in a way, threatening to the existence of anybody like myself. And so Exit West, which is a novel that responds to this current moment of anxiety about migration and the current search for purity that we see all around us, was born really out of this story. Let me tell you a little bit about the book, because I know some of you have read it, but some other of you may not have. Exit West is the story of two young people, Saeed and Nadia, living in a city that descends into a civil war, and horrific violence occurs. And they leave their city by means of these black doors, which begin to open all over the world. And if you pass through one of these black doors, you arrive somewhere far away. And so they go from their city to Greece, and from there to London, and eventually to Marin County in California. And the novel follows their journey, it follows their migrations, and it follows the migrations of some other people and what gets left behind. It's a love story between these two. And it's a story about our world today and possibly our world tomorrow. The first thing I'm often asked when people read this book is, you know, what's up with these doors? You know, why did you have these weird doors? I guess I should explain the doors. So the way the doors work in the book is that, for example, let's say in this auditorium, if you imagine one of these exit doors, well, these are more like curtained gaps, but pretend that that exit door was actually a door. You know, one evening, perhaps, when nobody was here, that door would be replaced by an opaque black rectangle. And similarly, a door maybe in your house, the door to your bathroom or the door to one of your closets, would become this opaque black rectangle. And if you approached this black rectangle and looked at it, you couldn't see through it. There'd be no reflection of you. There'd be nothing visible on the outside through it. And if you push yourself into this black rectangle, what happens is you will, with great effort, emerge on the other side, no longer in Portland, but somewhere far away, somewhere like Tokyo or Cairo or Caracas. And as people begin to pass through these doors, our world begins to change. The next couple centuries of human migration occur in the novel in just a year or two. Billions of people move. And so when I'm asked, you know, what's up with these doors, like why do you have these doors? I think the first thing I should say is that to a certain extent, these doors, I think, already exist. Not the physics of them. It's not that, you know, we can actually push ourselves through doors like that, abiding by the laws of physics as we currently understand them. But each of us does carry on us, I'm sure almost everybody in this room of perhaps 2,000 people will have in their bag, in their pocket, in their backpack, they will have a black rectangle, which is the screen of their hopefully silenced phone. And, you know, our phones stay in this black rectangle state when they're not doing anything. And they call out to us. They summon us. They demand our attention. They're like the ring in The Lord of the Rings, you know, which is sort of calling out to you, you know, my precious, and you put your finger into your pocket to touch this ring, and it, you know, some of you, I think, are probably doing that right now, and it's, you know, it's an addiction, it's a compulsion, it's an extension of ourself. And when you misplace your phone, as I actually just did 5 minutes ago, I was coming here and I was going to silence my phone, or perhaps I was just addictively drawn to touching it, I discovered that my phone wasn't in my pocket. And hopefully it's on its charger in my hotel room. But I did feel incredible anxiety. And when we misplace our phones, we do feel this anxiety. It's not like misplacing, you know, a pair of shoes or a t-shirt. It's something else. Even more than losing a wallet, a phone has a hold on us. So we have these phones, and what do they do? When you look at the black rectangle of your phone and you activate it and you look into its screen, what happens is your mind ceases to be in the geographic location of your body. You go far away. You go to the place where that particular cat was, you know, engaging in whatever adorable yarn hunting exercise that the video that was sent to you, or in my case, you know, my children will have recorded some video or some message, usually demanding presents, extracting from me the sort of, you know, emotional through emotional blackmail. Presence to justify the fact that I've been away for so long. And when I watch these videos, my mind actually is in Lahore, Pakistan, where my children are. But equally, we can be sent links to newspaper articles that will take us to Afghanistan or Florida or Argentina. We can read about plans to colonize the surface of Mars. We can follow the lineage of fictional characters in Westeros. We can go anywhere. This black rectangle takes us away from our body continuously. And the black doors in the novel, in a sense, are an expression for me of this technological reality that we live in. Reality is functioning to obliterate physical distance. It's done so for our minds already. It is doing so for our bodies. It's very cheap to move things from one place to another. We don't yet have black doors to move around, but I not long ago was on a different continent, and then I stepped into the door of an aircraft and emerged here. And so these doors, which are quite central to the novel, for me are not necessarily that different from the world we live in today. A little different, but hopefully they capture something of what we're all feeling right now, of what it's like to be living in this moment of the 21st century. It's also worth bearing in mind that what we think of as reality is not entirely real. So each of my books has, in a way, played with the idea of what is real and what is not. My first novel was called Moth Smoke, and in that novel, you, the reader, are cast as the judge of a kind of surreal trial where all the main characters tell you their version of events, and you're presented with things like a memorandum on the role that air conditioning has played in the lives of all the characters. In The Rotten Fundamentalist, my second novel, a young man in Pakistan meets presumably an American stranger and starts telling him his story, and it takes place over several hours. But of course, we know that nobody would really just sit there listening to a story for so long. There's a sort of theatrical quality to that novel, as though it's a one-man play. How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia is a novel about how to get filthy rich in Rising Asia, but it is also completely not about that. It's the story of really a different kind of migration, the migration from the countryside to the cities, and the story of one man's life from childhood until the end of his life in old age. And in this novel, 70 years of a man's life passes, but no historical time passes. In the beginning of the novel, we have DVDs and computers, and we have the same thing at the end. That novel also, in a way, messes with what time is. So I suppose I've written novels that, to me, feel realistic while admitting that things aren't really real. And so the doors in this novel are that element of slight unrealness. I think it's useful to keep a slight sense of unrealness in our approach to life, in our fictions, and how we think about things, because it reminds us that we make up so much of reality. This podium that I'm speaking at, for example, you know, I think it's a solid object, and yet we know that mostly this is empty space, that there are relatively sparsely scattered atoms across this empty space, and what I perceive as real, you know, is in fact something quite different than I imagine it to be. And the color of it, this sort of brown, there is no brown, actually. You know, this thing that I think of as brown is the way that my mind makes sense of the reflection of light of particular frequencies off of objects. And even this person, me, who's speaking to you, modern neuroscientists, as well as ancient mystics, will all tell us that this self, this person, is at least partly invented. We make up who we are. We are partly fictional. You know, sometimes I'll walk down the street and I'll do something, you know, nasty or mean or unpleasant, I'll lose my temper, and I'll think, oh, I wasn't myself. But the truth is, I am myself, actually. It's just that the story that we each tell about ourselves doesn't fit what we do. Because to a certain extent, the stories we tell about ourselves are invented. We make them up. And so in this novel, hopefully the doors function to make a certain emotional reality possible by reminding us of the slightly unreal nature of the world we imagine actually exists. They also do something, which is they allow a kind of compression to happen. And the migration in the novel is of an enormous scale. And I wanted to explore what would happen with this enormous scale of migration, but in a human time frame of just a year or two. And the doors make that possible. The last thing is that the doors remove, I think, a part of the journey that we often focus on so much. These days, we spend so much time, so much of our storytelling when we think of migrants and refugees focuses on how they got from one place to another. And these stories are incredibly important because people experience all kinds of terrible things when they migrate. They experience death. But if all we think of people is that they've had the experience of crawling under the barbed wire at the border or crossing the seas on a small raft that capsized, it's easier for us to say, well, that's what defines this person. I haven't crawled under the barbed wire. I haven't crossed the seas on a raft. I'm a different sort of person. And the focus that we have on the story of how we get from place to place, I think, allows us to think of the migrant and the refugee as something different from ourselves, when actually they're not different from us. They are precisely us. In fact, each of us has lived in a place and thought of leaving it. And each of us has settled into a new place, even if that's just leaving our parents' home and moving into our own home. And in this sense, the fundamental aspects of what any migrant experiences, so something that we've all experienced, and hopefully the doors begin to take away our focus on part of the story that lets us pretend that the migrant and the refugee isn't us, when in fact they are us. I think naming is very interesting and very important. We these days speak with names so easily. We you know, say words like America and Pakistan and Islam and Christianity. And these proper nouns are like brands. They bring with them all these sorts of meanings. When I moved back to Pakistan and I began work on my novel before this one, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, I made the decision to use no names at all. The only names in that book are the names of continents. Otherwise, no character has a name, no religion has a name, no place has a name. And I did this in part because I thought, you know, I need to describe things for myself. I don't want to say Pakistan or Islam or anything like that, you know, because those words have been defined by other people. Rather, I should say, you know, this is this place, and here's what it's like to be this place. This is the way this particular person has faith or no faith. This is what it means to them. This is how they experience it. I think sometimes taking names away helps us describe things for ourselves, in the same way that taking brands away lets us better understand what branding attempts to conceal from us. And in this novel, the nameless city where they begin is nameless for partly this reason, so that it can be described. It's nameless partly because it is open to the reader, that you, the reader, can put into that nameless city what you imagine it to be. Perhaps the city of your parents, or your own city, or the city of your lover, or a city of your friend, or the city of something you've read about in the newspaper or seen on television. And the nameless city becomes a starting point for the reader's imagination. I think that it's important to remember that how much of novels are imagined by readers. That, for me, is the unique form, the unique aspect of the form of the novel, the degree to which readers make them. But also, the nameless city is unnamed because I did base it, to a certain extent, on Lahore, Pakistan, where I live, and of a nightmare that I have, which is, what if Lahore were to undergo circumstances like those of Kabul or Baghdad or Sarajevo or Damascus or Aleppo? I'm sure in those cities, too, people once thought this could never happen here, and yet it has happened. And so I have this recurring nightmare that this might happen in Lahore, where I live. And so the starting city of Sayyidina Nadia is my nightmare given form. I think that it's a strange thing to live in our present day moment, where we each have our own private version of apocalypse, you know, what that looks like when our society collapses. It seems everywhere that we encounter ideas of apocalypse. And the city that Sayyidina Nadia begin with is an apocalypse like this. But namelessness in the novel isn't simply the city where they begin. It's also every character in the novel who isn't Sayyid or Nadia. The only two named characters in the book are these two, Sayyid and Nadia, Nadia and Sayyid. And the reason for that is that they are the emotional thread that will take you through this narrative, that you come back to again and again. And that the other characters who come, and there are many other characters in many other places, some of them will never even meet Nadia and Sayyid. throughout this journey, we will remain focused on these two, on the relationship between them. The naming of these two characters gives a kind of emphasis and a kind of focus to a novel that moves across lots and lots of space. These sorts of questions, the doors, the naming, these are questions that relate to something that we writers think about all the time, which is form. Oftentimes when one encounters a book, you know, the story is very important, and of course the story is important, the language is important, and yes, that is also important. But it's worth also thinking about the form that a novel takes. How is it built? Why was it built that way? I think that each novel has an appropriate form. Each story has an appropriate form. The word novel means, of course, new. And we invent new things with novels. But I think form is part of that. That newness in form is also something that the novel does. And it does this because every story has an appropriate way of being told, the way in which it can reach its reader best and have the power that hopefully it can have. In my own books, my first novel, Moth Smoke, is a trial where you, the reader, are the judge. It's a novel about a judgmental society, and positioning you as judge is entirely appropriate. My second novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, is a novel about, my second novel, The Ultimate Fundamentalist, is a novel about a Pakistani man who meets an American man, and you never hear the American man speak. It's a dramatic monologue, like a speech by one person speaking to you, the audience, this American person. And that novel functions by, in a sense, giving you half a story and forcing you, the reader, to provide the other half. And as you try to provide the other half and you try to stabilize the story, you try to figure out, is the narrator, what is he saying? Is it true? What's going on here? Because you don't have enough information to really know what is going on, you must, in the act of stabilizing that novel, provide your own instincts, your impulses, what your gut is telling you. And that's a novel about how a half conversation can provoke in each of us a kind of response, a reading response, and that it's worthwhile for each of us to look at that reading response, because we do live in a world where we're so often being given half the story. And we need to be aware, each of us, how we react to half a story. What are our biases? What are our instincts? And in that sense, the novel tries to be a kind of mirror to the reader, where you tell not only the end of that story, but you tell what kind of story it really is, and hopefully are aware of that, because it's very important that we be aware of how we're filling in these gaps in stories and making things into full stories without enough information in a deeply suspicious world where we're told that we belong to different sides. My third novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, takes the form of a self-help book, in which the main character, you, is this figure who is trying to get filthy rich in Rising Asia. Now, the self-help book form, I think, is appropriate because in many ways I write novels to help myself, to figure things out, to understand me, this world, what I'm thinking, to make sense of things. And I read them in part for that reason too. And I thought, well, if novels, you know, do function at least partly as a way to help oneself, if only to help oneself pass the time or to feel connected to something else, maybe one should explicitly write a novel that is a self-help book, which this novel pretends to be. I didn't actually expect when I wrote that book that it would show up, you know, in business school curriculums saying, you know, this is how you get filthy rich in Rising Asia. It's an excellent guide. But there you go. I mean, you know, fiction works in funny, mysterious ways. But that novel also tried to take an older form, the form of the Sufi love poem. Sufism is the mystical strand within Islam, a sort of love-based approach to religion, in which it's thought that love can allow us to transcend the predicament of being mortal beings. And very often Sufi poems are written to a beloved you, and they explore the way in which love can help liberate us from the tyranny of a limited life. And so I wanted to write a novel that was both this guide to getting rich, which is what it seemed to me so much, so many people in Pakistan, in Asia, and all over the world have been forced to become obsessed with, if not to become rich, at least to avoid becoming crushingly poor. But I thought, could this older Sufi form offer a kind of antidote to this way of thinking? And that gave us the form of that book. Exit West has a very different form. Each of my three books, as I've sort of described to you, my first three books, takes as a form something which it isn't quite. They pretend to be one thing, but are possibly something else. They ask you, the reader, to figure out the gap between the two things. They tell you that they are going to be dishonest, and therefore, hopefully, are more honest. But when I started writing Exit West, I felt I needed a different kind of form, a different approach to writing this book. And part of the reason for that was that when I began writing fiction, I had just spent the 1980s in General Zia-ul-Haq's dictatorship in Pakistan. And at that time, an attempt was made by the general to Islamize Pakistan. Now this, you might imagine, was a bit of a strange thing to do because Pakistan is something like 97% Muslim. So, you'd think that there were other things probably more worthwhile than trying to up the Muslimness of Pakistan. But the general would have disagreed with you, and he would have perhaps said that no, these people are not really Muslims. The way that they practice Islam is not really Islam. And if you were to ask him, you know, but who knows what really is, he would, I'm sure, have told you, I do, actually. And so he proceeded to, you know, ban public performances of dance. He proceeded to insist on a kind of, you know, purity in public conduct, a complete hypocrisy, to try to desiccate, to try to suck the lifeblood out of everyday life. And this was a horrific environment to grow up in. It also has horrific consequences for what Pakistan is today. And it happened in full alliance with the United States because Pakistan and the United States were allies waging a jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in those days. It's hard to imagine today, I think, for young people, but in those days, the U.S. was helping train jihadis like Osama bin Laden to go and fight in Afghanistan with the help of the Pakistani dictatorship. And so when I began writing fiction, it felt important to attack this false purity, to write about characters who were deeply dishonest, who were having adulterous sex, who were doing drugs and lying and you know, basically being human beings. So my initial novels, in a way, were about this, about trying to find in untrustworthiness, untrustworthy narratives, truth. But I think today we live in different times. And when I set out to write Exit West, what I discovered was, what I thought was that, you know, we live now in a moment where the most powerful people in the world are telling us that there is no truth, that no one is decent. And so it seemed to me that the radical artistic response required in this moment, at least that I thought was required, was to write a book that said exactly what it meant, and that was about people who were trying, imperfectly, but trying to be decent. And that for me was a big departure. And I thought, you know, how do you write a book that says what it means and where the people are trying to be decent? You know, what a weird idea it seemed. Now, when it comes to language, because of course books are composed not merely of the devices and approaches to form, but also of sentences, it became important to figure out what kind of sentences should Exit West be written in. You know, Moth Smoke, my first novel, was a kind of noirish book, you know, written in these more staccato, almost hard-boiled, crime fiction-y language, because that was the kind of hard-boiled crime fiction-y Lahore I wanted to depict. The Reluctant Fundamentalist, the language was of a young man who's trying to show, because his family is broke, that he belongs to an upper-class background, and so he speaks in a way that signals that, and his language is that. And How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia deploys the language appropriate in a way to a bizarre self-help book that is in fact not really a self-help book, or maybe a different kind of self-help book. And so it has a language for that. And this book, as I was writing it, I began to feel that it was like a kind of magic spell, or like a sort of non-religious prayer. It was summoning forth something. It was trying to call into existence something. And the language that is appropriate to the magic spell, or the language that is appropriate to the prayer, is a language that we all know well. It is something that has a certain rhythm, and it has a certain cadence. And in America, I like to tell people that, you know, one of the best ways in which we can think about this is to consider why, for example, the speeches of Martin Luther King had the power that they did. It wasn't simply that what Martin Luther King was saying was morally correct and just. Of course it was morally correct and just. But his speeches were more powerful than simply articulations of what should be. His speeches had a certain power from their rhythm, from their cadence. When King spoke, he set up rhythms in the language. And as you listened, you began to align with those rhythms. You began to anticipate those rhythms. And you started to go along with these rhythms. And by aligning yourself with these rhythms, with anticipating the next beat of the speech, already being in sync, when the quite, in some cases, radical and shocking content of those speeches presented itself, it presented itself to people who were already going along. At a visceral human level, we were already nodding along to what he was saying. And then, when the moral power of his words presented itself, it hit much more powerfully. This is often the way that prayer or magic spells works. And so I wanted to do something like that. And the sentences in this book, these long, hopefully, sentences with cadence and a particular kind of rhythm, establish in the reader a sort of expectation that this is how things will flow. And in that flow, the reader is hopefully carried along, and some ideas that are perhaps radical ideas or ideas that the reader might otherwise find more objectionable come to seem a little bit more inevitable, a little bit more welcome, because they have come with a rhythm that one instinctively understands and feels. I studied writing with Toni Morrison, and she once said to me and to her class that in fiction you should always be a half heartbeat ahead of the reader. That what comes next should not be known, but when it comes, it should feel inevitable. And rhythm, language can do that, which is what this novel tries to do. Now, I think I should probably turn to the core of the book, which is the love story and the issue of migration. And they're related. First, a word on the love story. Exit West is a love story between Sayed and Nadia, and between many other people, but primarily between Sayed and Nadia, and it is what we call a first love. And a first love is something that many of us will have experienced. The high school students in this audience may be experiencing it right now, or may experience it soon. And for those of you who are young enough to have only experienced first love, you will call it something different. You will call it love. Those of us who are a little bit older, we use the term first love because there was a second. And maybe a third. A love story about a first love is the love story about a love that will end. And this notion for me of transience, of the fact of endings, that things do end, was very important. The novel is really a novel about letting go. How do we let go of the place where we've lived? How do we let go of the people that we care most for, our parents, our friends? And how do we let go of people we love? And of course, in life, we must also ask, how do we let go of life itself at one point? I think this notion of letting go is very important. We live in a moment where we are being told, where we are offered the sort of false promise of permanence. We are told that we can be young forever. Our countries can remain this way forever. Our cities can remain this way forever. But that's not how reality works. That's not how existence works. Above all, that's not how time works. The reality of it is that we will each lose everything. That is what it is to be a human being. To be a human being is to be in one moment, and then the next moment, and then the next moment. Being in one moment at a time, and each of those moments takes something from you. And so it was, to me, very important to explore, how do we deal with this? I think what's partly happened is that the complete conquest of the market and the principle of self-interest, which we associate with the market, has had at least one, well, many, but at least one in this context, a very dangerous effect, which is, if we each believe that self-interest is how the world should be governed and is the fundamental principle on which we should build our societies and our culture, what do we do about the fact that one day our self will end? Self-interest doesn't really give us an answer to the fact of what we do, that our self ends. And so we are left perplexed, and we are left horrified, and we are left deeply depressed. I think the world at the moment is in a kind of global state of psychological depression. And you see manifestations of this all over the place, because when a young child in Pakistan goes into a shopping mall with bombs strapped to their body and detonates themselves and kills 20 or 30 or 50 strangers, or when a young child in an American school goes in with a gun and kills 20 or 30 strangers and themselves, what is happening in a world where things like this are going on with such frequency? What's happening is that we have completely lost sight of what a good ending, a desirable ending, might look like. We don't even speak of it. In what way should we end? In what way should we end our life when that time comes? But in what way should we end our relationship to another person? Say the Nadia story is an exploration of that. Is there a way to do this with beauty and with love and with affection? And that's very important, because there are so many wisdoms in the world that are neglected at the moment, of how we deal with the idea that the self ends, how we can still find wisdom and beauty and connection and optimism in the face of that. What we are told is that actually love makes it possible for us to transcend the tyranny of the fact that we each have to go one day, that things end. And now the kind of love that makes this possible, of course, is different from the way we often use the term love. Often when we say that I love someone, or if I love a woman, it's because I want her to be my wife or my girlfriend. If I love, your car or your house, I want that car, I want that house. We use the term love as a possessive. But it doesn't have to be possessive, actually. It's much more potent when it isn't possessive. Love has the potential of making us less rooted in ourselves. And an example of this, which I've seen recently, is I see my father playing with my daughter, his eldest grandchild, every morning before she goes to school and he goes to work. My father's brother passed away recently. My father's best friend passed away recently. And yet he speaks of the future with a kind of excitement. When we build the tree house, and when she learns to ride the bicycle, And what I have understood is that because of his love for her, his relationship to time is different. He sees what time is for her, and the future contains within it the potential for all sorts of happiness and hope. This, I think, is what is meant by a kind of transcendental love, that if we do love something outside ourselves, not because it makes us less lonely, but because deep down we want it to be less lonely, the other person to be less lonely, interesting things become possible. And that's the kind of love story that this is. It's a love story that tries to explore this particular condition. Now, the novel is, of course, about migration. But what it tries to do is to raise the possibility that, in fact, migration is the basic nature of what it means to be a human being. Each of us is a refugee from our childhoods. You know, you are no longer in that elementary or preschool class where your friends were. None of us are. Those kids have dispersed. Some of the teachers have passed away. The playground has been made into a parking lot. The ice cream vendor has you know, been replaced with something else. We can't return. And the woman who has lived in Portland, Oregon, her entire life, for the last 75 years, when she steps out onto the street today, she is not the person who stepped out onto the street 50 years ago, and the street is not the street it was 50 years ago. She's in a different country than what she experienced 50 years ago. Migration is a universal human experience, whether or not we move across physical distance or not. And of course, our ancestors have always moved across physical distances. Human beings didn't evolve in Oregon. You know, they came here from somewhere. They came everywhere from somewhere. And so we each come from migrants. We each are, at a fundamental level, migrants. And if we can recognize this in each other, it enables possibly a different kind of conversation. A conversation where we recognize that the person who is afraid of becoming a foreigner in the country where they have lived their entire life is actually participating in a very similar sorrow and a very similar fear to the person who's fled from their country to save their lives and misses the place that they came from. In fact, if we have a big enough sense of empathy to encompass both of these people, what we realize is that actually what both of these sorrows consists of is not a conflict between these two types of people, but the sadness of what it is to be a human being passing through time. And how do we address this? The last thing I wanted to say, because it speaks to the end of this book, how do we address this situation? It seems to me that it's essential that we have to look ahead with optimism. What's happened to us is, if you imagine in America in the 1960s, 50 years ago, if you ask people, what will the future look like? They would likely have said, oh, well, you know, there'll be flying, you know, cars and robot butlers and, you know, I'll have a yacht, you know, orbiting the moon. And there would have been a kind of sense of optimism. Or at the very least, they might have said that the current economic and racial disparity is beginning to get better and we'll live in a more equal society. But today, if you ask people, what will the future look like in 50 years? Very often what you will hear is a kind of pessimistic answer, like, I don't know. It could be much worse. Things could be really bad. Now, the problem when humanity begins to think of the future in this way, as something terrifying and frightening, is we turn away from the future. And we start looking to the past, and we begin to imagine that we can make of the past a future. We can never do this. It's impossible to bring back the past. And our attempts to do that usually result in something monstrous. When we try to make us what we formerly were, whether that is our bodies, our cultures, or our places that we live, we have to engage in a terrible violence in the attempt of making it like it was. And it isn't going to be like it was. It's an impossibility. But it gives birth to a kind of nostalgic politics, a politics of backward-lookingness. And I think that is very, very dangerous. I think the politics of looking backwards is much like the individual who can't confront the reality of getting older. It results in a kind of personal and collective horror. And so it's important for us to begin to imagine optimistic visions of the future. And Exit West it tries to begin to imagine something like this. 200 years ago, Portland was a very different place from what it is now. 200 years from now, Portland will be just as different from this place as Portland today is from Portland of 200 years ago. And yet, the 200 years in the future Portland can be as much more wonderful than this Portland is to that one, with better health care, with exciting new music, with good food. I think that partly we are recoiling from the world of migration because we aren't yet telling enough stories about how the mixing is good for us. You know, our species was designed to have two people come together to make a child, to mix their DNA and create something new out of the mixture. And nature does this because the something new over time gets better and better and better. We could simply detach our foot, you know, and grow a new person, you know, like an amoeba who was exactly like ourselves, but nature didn't go down that route. And I think that we don't want to do that really as societies either, to sort of become these purity-obsessed things. And so the notion I wanted to leave you with, and as we begin to move into questions and answers, is that I think it is incumbent upon each of us as citizens and human beings to be optimistic. Not uncritically so, but to recognize the harm that we do to ourselves and to our societies and to the world by being pessimistic. It is not consequence-free to be pessimistic. To be pessimistic is to facilitate the exact kind of politics and intolerance and self-loathing that is harming us the most. As a father, one thing that I've learned is sort of my job is to be an optimist. And, you know, you can't sort of wake your kids up and say, oh my goodness, today is going to be a really bad day. You know, it's this drive to this other town is going to be so boring. It's a you know, it results in severe civil disobedience on the part of the children. And so I think what I want to leave you with is this notion of optimism and above all the notion that literature is part of that. Because what literature reminds us is, as each of us sits by ourselves reading a book, and we contain within ourselves our own thoughts and the thoughts of another person, and we live in this kind of fertile state as a reader. When you read a book, you're in this fertile state. Your mind is this womb with the DNA of your own thoughts and the DNA of the words of the book, and they're mixing and they're creating an experience. And if out of that experience can come something that you desire and something you like, out of that mixture, which brings you back to reading books again and again and again, why should we doubt that the mixing of people can't do precisely the same thing? Thank you very much.
That was Mohsen Hamid speaking as part of Everybody Reads 2018 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. Find these and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. The show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.